We commence today's show, speaking of great hours, in conversation with NYU law professors and MSNBC contributors Melissa Murray and Andrew Weissman about their new book, their number one new book, The Trump Indictments. The text dissects the four unprecedented indictments against Donald Trump and features extensive commentary from both of our guests, who I am pleased to welcome to this program right now. I'm happy to say that many years ago, before the rest of y'all knew who she was, I had discovered, let me take all the credit for it, right, Melissa Murray and her brilliance, and she was a contributor to one of my prior programs, and I'm honored to be reunited with her again to celebrate her book, The Trump Indictments. Professor Murray, how are you today?
Thank you for having me, and I'm so glad you noted that you did discover me, because you gave me my start, and I'm incredibly appreciative.
I was being somewhat tongue in cheek, but I was honored. I was honored, Melissa, to have you on repeatedly back then as a contributor to our program on PBS. I'm grateful for those appearances, and again, just when I saw the book come out, I couldn't wait to get a copy of it. And when I saw it start to climb the ladder on the list, I was celebrating you here in LA. So congratulations on all that you've done over these years, and again, a delight to be in conversation with you. Not to leave you out, Professor Weissman, how are you today, sir?
I'm very good. I'm looking forward to the conversation, and it's nice to actually meet you.
It's a pleasure to meet you virtually, at least, and audibly. Again, congratulations to both of you on the success of the book, and the timing of it obviously could not be more propitious given what's happening even as we speak. We'll try to weave some of that in as we move through this hour. Melissa, I'll come to you first. Give me, I know what it is, but give me a sense of why and how this book came to be, and more about the way the book is actually laid out, and then we'll jump into the pages of it.
Sure. So Andrew and I are both professors at NYU, so we spend most of our days talking to students about the law, breaking down complex legal topics into more digestible bits, and then we spend a lot of our evenings on MSNBC doing the same thing for an audience that isn't comprised of wannabe lawyers. And so when these indictments were issued last year, we saw this as a really important opportunity to do a public service by helping the public, many of whom will not be trained as lawyers, to understand what's going on in this unprecedented moment. So the book is laid out in a really easily accessible fashion. We've collected all four indictments. We've provided some context for the indictments by introducing it with a really lengthy essay explaining how we got here and how these indictments stack up with other systems, other democracies, and their efforts to hold leaders, whether current leaders or former leaders, to account for misconduct undertaken before, during, or after their time in office. So we provide some really important global context for these indictments. And then each indictment is preceded by an essay explaining what the crux of the indictment is and sort of what are the difficult aspects of this and how does it relate to other similar prosecutions of individuals who are not the former president of the United States. So some context there as well. And then the meat of each indictment is the text that was provided by what we like to call our ghostwriters, Alvin Bragg, Fani Willis, and Jack Smith. But we've heavily annotated these indictments to give the reader an opportunity to really understand what's going on, why certain choices were made. In some cases, we provide information about places and locations and people that, you know, we cross-reference with news sources to make clear who these individuals are and how they fit into this narrative and how they fit in across the different indictments as well. So it's really chock full of insider notes and lots of information so that the person listening at home or reading at home or trying to follow what's going on at home can really have an essential guidebook that they can consult as all of these trials go forward, or if just one of these trials goes forward.
There's a lot to interrogate in this hour. I'll commence by saying this, that I've had the honor of having a couple number one books in my life, and I can assure you that you don't get to number one without a book that can be read and understood by a massive amount of people. And so the great accomplishment, the great achievement here, as you'll discover as we move through this hour, is that these two law professors who teach legalese and oftentimes speak in legalese have found a way to make their intellects usable. And I can assure you, when you get the book, The Trump Indictments, the historic charging documents with commentary, Even I, Tavis Smiley, can understand it and can follow it. And that's not easy. Those aren't easy doings when you trying to address issues that can be this complicated and this complex. So kudos to Melissa Murray and Andrew Weissman, our guests in this hour, both professors at NYU in the law program there, law school, and both contributors to MSNBC for writing a book that every one of us can understand. We will break it down for you when we come forward with them on Tavis Smiley.
You're listening to Tavis Smiley.
Tavis Smiley.
Ranked number 45 on the Heavy 100 list of the 100 most important radio talk show hosts in America. Let's get back to more of this rich dialogue with Tavis Smiley.
It's a New York Times number one bestseller. It's called The Trump Indictments, the historic charging documents with commentary. The authors of the text are NYU professors and MSNBC contributors Melissa Murray and Andrew Weissman, who I'm honored to have on this program for the hour. Professor Weissman, Andrew, let me come to you. You heard your colleague Melissa Murray say a moment ago that this is unprecedented. We are clearly in an unprecedented moment. And I'm trying to find another word for the unprecedented. I need to look up a synonym for that because everybody is calling this moment unprecedented. Two words I've heard more times than I can count over the last few months. One is unprecedented. The other is existential. Donald Trump represents an existential threat to our democracy. We hear that word time and time again. And we keep being told every day in a variety of ways and places that this moment is, in fact, unprecedented. My question for you, sir, is how unprecedented is this moment given these Trump indictments?
For our country, there's no question that this is both unprecedented and existential. But one of the things that, Melissa sort of alluded to is, and we write about in the introduction to the book, is trying to put what we are facing in this country in context with what other countries have faced in holding political leaders to account. You know, we are really bad at this, and we think of ourselves as Americans as part of sort of American exceptionalism, and that we have sort of a magic answer to being the rule of law country, and that we are the product of American exceptionalism, and we hold our justice system to this exalted view that it is somehow better than other systems. And one of the things that I think we try to convey to people is this is new for us in America, but many, many other countries and countries that we consider to be so-called Western democracies mm-hmm. have been through this. They have held political leaders to account, and it is actually a function of a healthy democracy to do that. It is part of the rule of law to be able to hold political leaders who engage in corruption to account in the same way that all of us are held to the rule of law. And you see it, whether it's in Argentina, in France, in Italy, in Israel, just a host of other countries have done this successfully. They have barred in Brazil people who have engaged in conduct similar to that alleged with respect to Donald Trump from running for office. And so, yes, this is a first for us, but by no means is it a sign of weakness of our democracy. It is a sign of health that we are actually not viewing a former president as a former king, but as somebody who was supposed to have worked for us, and it should be held to account like anyone else. Mm-hmm. So I think that's a useful context in terms of what we are experiencing now, to see that we are actually behind the curve in terms of where other healthy democracies are in doing what we are seeing being done now for the first time in a Manhattan courtroom.
Yep. Let me challenge the thesis of this notion of accountability, Melissa Murray, and give me a second to set it up, and I'll yield to you. I mentioned a moment ago that we've heard a number of terms repeatedly and will between now and November. One word we hear all the time, again, is unprecedented. Indeed, these times are. We hear that word existential all the time in reference to Donald Trump, but we also hear repeatedly that no one is above the law. No one is above the law. We talk about the rule of law. We love saying that. No one is above the law. I'm not so sure I buy that. And as Andrew Weissman was talking, I'm thinking of a number of presidents. I could call their names, don't need to. But I'm thinking of one president who people still regard as a war criminal for what he did invading Iraq, looking for weapons of mass destruction that we never found. I'm thinking of another president who was engaged in Iran-Contra. I could do this all day if I had the time. There are a number of presidents who have not really been above the law. There are a lot of presidents who've gotten away with breaking the rule of law. There are a lot of presidents who really ain't been held accountable. Here we come in this moment with this rhetoric that no one is above the law, playing devil's advocate. I'm not sure I buy it, Melissa Murr.
So, I mean, these are all really interesting examples, and despite your efforts to not say names, I think it's pretty clear who you're talking about, Tavis. So, you know, one way I think you can think about those questions are, like, they are, I think, interlaced with political dynamics. You know, in constitutional law, we might say that questions about whether a president has discharged his authority to direct troops to a particular region, that's a political question, something that has been constitutionally committed to a particular branch of government and over which there is no opportunity for judicial review or adjudication. So, you know, that might be a gloss that perhaps distinguishes those circumstances from what we are seeing now, where, you know, some of the crimes that have been alleged and charged here are kind of anodyne crimes. So, you know, the context in New York is that the predicate crime is the falsification of business records. Lots of people falsify business records in New York and are held accountable for it. Here, it is a president who is going to be held accountable. But I think the fact that if we did not hold the president accountable for it, we'd have real questions about whether we were holding the president above the law, whether there was equal justice for everyone, or, you know, are we just bringing in ordinary people on these charges. The Mar-a-Lago case, I think, presents some real questions that sort of skirt the edges of not just anodyne criminal conduct, but anodyne criminal conduct that can have really important and global implications. You know, there are plenty of people right now in federal penitentiaries because they improperly retained information that was marked as classified. And, like, not even lots of information, just sort of like random bits of information, not anything on the scale of what former President Donald Trump is accused of retaining. And leaving aside some of the other allegations in that indictment, which really focus on the obstruction efforts to prevent those documents from being returned to the National Archives where they belong. So that to me seems like a very serious distinction, one that not only imperils our national security, but also compromises relationships with allies who also help us to preserve our national security at home and abroad. And then there's the election interference scheme. Those are the center, those charges are the center of both Fani Willis's state level indictment and Jack Smith's federal indictment. And those charges go to the very heart of what it means to be a democracy. From the beginning of our country, the idea that we have peaceful transitions of power, regardless of who wins. And we saw it in 2000 with Bush Gore, where, yes, a decision has been made. Not everyone agrees with it, but we all abide by it. That was not the case on January 6th, 2021. And that's what it means to be a democracy, to be able to transition power, to do so without coup-like behavior. And, you know, it is worth thinking about whether a president who is alleged to have been deeply involved in that effort, is that someone that we can let go just because he's a former president? I'd say we probably can, and certainly not in a circumstance where that person may be in a position to be in office again in the future.
I want to circle back in a moment, Melissa Murr, to your point about politicization. When I referenced those other presidents, and of course, I was talking about George Bush and Ronald Reagan, just to name two. I was being somewhat tongue-in-cheek. By not calling their names, obviously, I knew the audience would know who I was talking about. But Donald Trump, if he were here in this conversation, would make the argument that this is politicized. It's politicized in two ways, that the charges against him are politicized and that he was making political decisions. I mean, one could laugh at the argument, but he's made that argument that would not distinguish him in this instance from Bush or Reagan. Put a pin in that for just a second. I'll come back to that. But since you referenced your ghostwriters on this book, namely Alvin Bragg, let me come to this, Melissa, and then I'll go back to Andrew Weissman, because you said this and I want to follow up. When it comes to Alvin Bragg, one could make the case, I'm going to make it now for the sake of argument, that the flip side of holding people accountable is overcharging people. And certainly as black folk, we know all about that. Cases every day where we are overcharged, sadly, regrettably, and frankly. in a sort of racist way. But one could argue that when Alvin Bragg brings Donald Trump up on 34 charges, and that's basically because he wrote multiple checks for the same crime, one could argue that that's overcharging. That ain't accountability. Donald Trump would say, that's overcharging me.
So just, again, this is an argument that Donald Trump has made, and he has made it, I think, quite cynically, while also sort of claiming to understand the black experience of the criminal justice system because this is happening to him. And I really want to push back on that narrative, certainly with your listeners. You know, as a black woman, I am very attentive to the problem of over-criminalization of black and brown bodies. But I don't think this is that, right? The idea that you have written checks for different instances of payments for one thing, which is to cover up the fact of an extramarital affair, that's what is alleged in the indictment. Lots of people, lots of black and brown people go to jail, have been charged with and been convicted of multiple counts of doing the same thing in furtherance of a single goal. So that's not unusual. And in fact, it would be selective enforcement to let Donald Trump off the hook for that when so many black and brown people have been criminally convicted for doing exactly the same kind of thing. But I also want to sort of put this in a broader context. It isn't simply about writing a check, Tavis. Mm-hmm. It's about the prospect of withholding information that might be relevant to your wife, but it's also very relevant to the voting public who in 2016 might have made different choices mm-hmm. about who they wanted to support if they understood the full measure of what those checks meant and what those payments meant. You know, one of the things that Alvin Bragg has to establish beyond a reasonable doubt, I mean, Donald Trump doesn't have to do anything here. He just has to let Alvin Bragg fail. And Alvin Bragg has to prove beyond a reasonable doubt that Donald Trump falsified those business records in furtherance of some kind of election fraud scheme or tax fraud scheme related to keeping this information from the voting public. Alvin Bragg in the indictment suggests that this was all done in after the Access Hollywood tape emerged and where many people had questions about whether Donald Trump had the temperament to be president, whether this was the kind of person we wanted to be president. And for that reason, the fact of these extramarital affairs or alleged extramarital affairs became really, really urgent and needed to be covered up. And Donald Trump didn't just pay off these individuals. Mm-hmm. He also enlisted the National Enquirer, like a media source, in order to catch and kill these stories. So it's not just about writing checks. I mean, it is about this broader effort to defraud the voting public. And, you know, Donald Trump also says that this particular prosecution is a species of election fraud because it's intended to impact the 2024 election. I would argue that the election fraud that's alleged in the indictment is actually as important, maybe more important than anything that he could offer as a defense. Like, did he actually do all of this, coordinate the scheme in order to keep the voting public from knowing the full truth of the man that they were trying to determine should be their president?
I've got 2 minutes here now. We'll continue when we come forward. But Andrew Weissman, let me get you started at least on the response to this. I'm thinking of the biblical admonition that wisdom is the principal thing. Wisdom is the principal thing, but we are told that in all of our getting, we should get an understanding. When people get inside this book about these four Trump indictments and they get an understanding of what is really at stake here, what are they going to see, broadly speaking?
Yeah, so keeping it broad, but continuing the theme that Melissa and you have been discussing, it's really important to note when you're comparing this to other presidents and then other people that you have here in the four indictments that we discuss in this book, criminality that is engaged in before Donald Trump was president, while he was president, and after he was president. So, Tavis, the examples you gave, as awful as they are for, I think, many people listening to this, are about conduct in office. And Melissa's point is they're not all criminal. They may be things that people strongly disagree with, but they're not all criminal acts. But here, if you're talking about, let's say, the Manhattan case, which is focused on a scheme to get somebody into office, and the Mar-a-Lago classified documents and obstruction case is about facts after somebody was in office. Well, there's nothing about being president that suddenly should immunize you from crime that is routinely prosecuted prior to you when you were president and crimes that are routinely prosecuted after you were president. So one of the things that our book does is try to sort of essentially lay that all out. And finally, one thing that Melissa and I do is, as law professors, is we're giving people tools. We're expressing our views now,
right.
But the point of the book is to give people tools so they can make up their own mind.
Yeah. I love a law professor that can get right to the point, and Andrew Weissman did just that. The difference with Donald Trump is that this former president is a criminal before, during, and after his presidency. Think about that, before, during, and after, and that's why we're talking about this book, and that is why it is a number one New York Times bestseller. It's called The Trump Indictments, The Historic Charging Documents with Commentary by the two authors, Melissa Murray and Andrew Weissman, both professors at NYU and both contributors to MSNBC, and both appearing right now, and I'm glad about it, on Tavis Smiley.
Seeking the truth. Speaking the truth. This is the Tavis Smiley Show. Sounds different, huh? This is Tavis Smiley.
This is Tavis Smiley in conversation with the authors of the New York Times number one bestseller, The Trump Indictments, the historic charging documents with commentary by the authors of the book, Melissa Murray and Andrew Weissman, both professors at NYU and both contributors to MSNBC and both appearing right now on this program. And I'm grateful for their time. Melissa, back to that point we were discussing earlier about politicization. Donald Trump, laughable though the argument may be, has argued in all of these cases that either he had the right to do what he did, he had the presidential authority to do what he did. You know that line of response. Unpack that for me, please, or critique that, if you will.
No, I mean, again, he has sort of offered a defense to these four indictments that sort of spans the gamut of one, you know, in the context of the January 6th election interference argument, indictment, that the argument for him is that he is immune from criminal prosecution because he is president. I mean, I think there are, again, broad questions about this. It's currently at the United States Supreme Court, which will hear oral arguments on the issue on April 25th. You know, if the Supreme Court does not move quickly, the question may be entirely academic because this indictment will not actually go to trial, and Donald Trump will effectively have been immunized by the Supreme Court's delay. But the question to my mind is a pretty straightforward one. As a matter of constitutional design, the president is not supposed to be a king. That's the whole issue behind having a president as opposed to a king, which is a choice that the founders made. We've never allowed a president to be above the law, but certainly refusing to hold him accountable by immunizing him from criminal prosecution and preventing a jury from deciding disputed questions of fact would effectively immunize him. In the context of the Mar-a-Lago indictment, the argument that he's advanced there is that he had a right to do this because the documents in question are his by virtue of the Presidential Record Act. And, you know, that argument is specious to the point of actually being stupid. You know, it is not the case that presidents get to have everything just because they're issued during the course of their presidency. In fact, the Presidential Records Act emerges in the wake of Watergate to make clear that documents that are produced in the conduct of the presidency are the property of the American public, not the president himself. They have to be archived. They have to be part of the nation's repository of its data, of its document, of its history. And so the idea that Donald Trump somehow made these documents his own simply by being president, like, it just doesn't hold water. What it does do is delay the conduct of these indictments, the processing of these indictments through to trial. Mm-hmm. And for Donald Trump, that's all it needs to do, because that's what he wants, because that would effectively be a win if we could delay any of these trials until November, when he has a chance to go before the American people. And if he is successful with the American people at the ballot box, he can kill the two federal indictments, and maybe he can complicate the question of whether he can continue to be prosecuted on the state level charges.
I'm only 40 minutes into a 3-hour program, but at the moment, that's the quote of the day. It's not just specious, it's stupid, so says Melissa Murray. That's our quote of the day so far. Andrew Weissman, because you all wrote this book and everybody's reading it, the Trump indictments, we have been told more than once by a number of analysts that the case that Alvin Bragg is advancing right now, the one that's underway in Manhattan as we speak, is the weakest of these four indictments. I've heard that 1,000 times, as have you and Melissa Murray. One, I want to ask whether or not you and Melissa agree with that assessment, that it is the weakest of the four. And I ask that in part because Donald Trump is still facing prison time, jail time, if he loses this case. I don't know how weak that is or can be. And then secondly, as I've reminded the audience on more than one occasion, they did in fact get Al Capone on tax evasion. So what appears to be particularly weak or especially weak can also be, it can end up being a home run. So you tell me whether the two of you agree with all the other experts I've been reading that this is the weakest of the four indictments.
So, you know, Melissa and I have talked about this a lot because one of the ways that Donald Trump benefits is, you know, he will say, for instance, so many things that are not true that you start going, well, that's only a small lie. That's not like the big lie he told a week ago. And so, yes, it is true that when you look at the nature of the four indictments, and again, just step back, we're talking about four indictments and 88 criminal charges, criminal felonies alleged. It is true that you can say, gee, this seems like the less serious. The two of the indictments relate to undermining the fundamental mechanisms of our democracy. Another is about the retaining of classified information, including nuclear secrets of this country and our adversaries, and obstruction of justice. So you could look at this and say, not that it's the weakest, but that it may be the less serious of a whole panoply of serious felonies. But that's sort of giving them the benefit of having been charged with so many other types of crimes. I also think that we should go back to a point that Melissa made, which is, I think, you know, that's, I would say to those people who are saying this doesn't seem that strong or that serious, wait. Let's see what the evidence is that comes out, because people have referred to this as a hush money case. Mm-hmm. But Melissa's point is that the way that Alvin Bragg has charged this is part of election interference in 2016 and very much a precursor to what we saw, you know, years later and are seeing now, which is a scheme to both keep damaging information about Donald Trump from seeing the light of day and disseminating negative information that it was false about his adversaries. And you're going to hear, according to the DA, lots of information on both aspects of that scheme, the sort of catch and kill, but also the dissemination of false information. So, for instance, the DA said that Michael Cohen's going to testify about paying money so that a poll would come out and be more favorable about people saying Donald Trump is a successful businessman and he'd appear at the top of that poll. But that was because he bought it. It was not he bought that result. That's not a fair and balanced presentation. By the same token, you're going to hear, according to the DA, information that was kept from the public where he got the National Enquirer to send him the headlines in advance for him to approve what would be the headlines about his political adversaries. Just think about that for a moment. It is a news organization or a media outlet that is saying we're going to be in cahoots with one political candidate about what they should do with respect to the campaign. And remember, they published information about Ted Cruz that was false. They actually went ahead and endorsed Donald Trump, but they were working with him behind the scenes, according to D.A. Bragg. So I would say, let's wait and see before people come to judgment about this case seeming to be just a small small potatoes kind of matter.
When we come forward, I want to ask Melissa Murray a couple of things, she and Andrew Weissman, in no particular order. One, this question looms as to whether or not Donald Trump can get a fair trial. Yesterday had seated seven juries in this case in Manhattan. One of those juries was excused today for fear that her identity was getting out. So it underscores the difficulty in trying to seat a jury to look at a case of a former president, the first former president to ever be criminally indicted. We'll talk about fair trial and whether Donald Trump can actually get a fair trial in this particular case, or for that matter, in any of the other cases in New York City or anywhere else. And I've been hearing some strange comparisons, some bizarre comparisons, although I want to unpack it with our guests, about Donald Trump's sex issue and Bill Clinton's sex issue. We'll talk about that part, as they say, when we come forward with Andrew Weissman and Melissa Murray on Tavis Smiling.
Hope, agency, dignity. This is Tavis Smiling.
Can you dig it?
Come on!
Ready to re-examine your assumptions and expand your inventory of ideas? More of Tavis Smiley coming your way right now.
Melissa Murray, you'll be happy to know I'm not the only person who thought that was a great line. I'm looking at people commenting on your commentary. It's specious almost to the point of being stupid. I ain't the only one who liked it, so there's that part. Watching my time is getting away from me. Let me ask you right quick, Melissa Murray, whether in Manhattan or any place else, and this is a legitimate question. I'm not asking this question to be snarky. There's a legitimate question to be asked about whether or not, and this is the danger and the difficulty, of course, in prosecuting former presidents. We've never seen anything like it. Here's that word, unprecedented, once again. But can Donald Trump in this case, or the other three, or in any city in this country, truly get a fair trial? I'm not suggesting that's a pretext for not prosecuting. I'm just asking a question.
Mm-hmm. No, it's a great question. You know, Manhattan trends overwhelmingly Democrat. There have been serious protests of former President Trump in Manhattan. But I think the thing we have to remember is that for most Americans, when you are called for jury service, you go there understanding what the assignment is. And the assignment is to walk into the jury box if you are selected as a juror and to take what is presented with an open mind. That's our civic duty. Like, the whole system cannot work unless we all endeavor to do that. And, you know, lots of people come to the courthouse with their own views, their own experiences, and they understand and they do shed those predilections, those predispositions when they serve on the jury. I've talked to jurors in my time as a clerk, and they take it incredibly seriously, and they have an open mind. And the thing for Donald Trump here is that he doesn't need all 12 jurors to agree that he should be acquitted. He literally just needs one person to believe that Alvin Bragg has not met his burden. And in all of the discussion of how Donald Trump is so persecuted and all of this, we lose sight of something that is fundamentally important, which is to say that the burden here is not on Donald Trump. Mm-hmm. It is on Alvin Bragg and the state to establish every element of the crimes charged beyond a reasonable doubt, to convince 12 people that they have presented an ironclad case that Donald Trump did this for the reasons they said he did this, and that he should be convicted on those charges. Yeah. It's an incredibly high burden.
When we come forward in our remaining moments with Melissa Murray and Andrew Weissman, let me frame this for Andrew Weissman now, and we'll get his response to it when we come forward. Here's the short framing, the short version. Clinton lied, obfuscated, and tried to cover up. Trump lied, obfuscated, and tried to cover up, albeit with payments. Isn't this ultimately about just trying to hide something that you didn't want to come out? And in that sense, some have argued there's not much difference between Donald Trump and Bill Clinton, except that one of them is being prosecuted, or as he would say, persecuted. We'll put that to Andrew Weissman when we come forward on Tavis Smiley.
What's your quarrel with the world? You're listening to Tavis Smiley. Who do you trust to get at the truth?
Tavis Smiley. Smiley.
That's who. The conversation continues right now.
I've got 4 minutes left here, and I want to give Andrew Weissman the last word. Melissa, to you right quick, if I can, on this. I mentioned earlier that that the judge let a juror go today because of fear that her identity was getting out. And the question essentially is, while I asked a moment ago whether Trump can get a fair trial, perhaps I should have asked whether the court can protect these jurors who serve in this case, given the political violence in this country. Your thoughts right quick?
No, it's a very difficult question. We actually discuss it at length in the book, in detailing some aspects of the various indictments where there were extraordinary and indeed unorthodox efforts to shield the identities of some of the grand jury members from the public because of this fear of political violence. This is a real question, and it's one that I think is of particular urgency given the nature of this defendant and those who follow him. So, you know, the court can do what it does and what it ordinarily does, but, you know, the court is not an enforcement arm in the way that we traditionally think about it. So, you know, they can make statements like this and they can hold individuals to account, but I don't know that they can control the many followers that follow this president.
The last 2.5 minutes, Andrew Weissman, belong to you. You heard my question moments ago about Clinton v. Trump, or Clinton as compared to Trump, which I think will give you a chance to reframe for the audience finally here why this moment is in fact so unprecedented. Take it away, Andrew Weissman.
Absolutely. So, you know, one of the things we do in the book is talk about the really getting to the heart of the question that you raise, which is trying to make sure that you can look at this and say, is this sort of a form of selective prosecution? Is Donald Trump being treated fairly? Mm-hmm. Is he being held to account regardless of what his last name is? And we go through all of the DOJ precedent, the Department of Justice precedent, Alvin Bragg's Manhattan precedent, for charging people in similar situations, or frankly, people who seem to have done a lot less. When you're talking about Bill Clinton, I think it sort of answers itself. The next time that we have a president who engaged in conduct that is illegally trying to thwart the democratic process, who engaged in filing substantial number of false business records in order to engage in a catch and kill scheme to present a false picture of himself and a rosy, which is a rosy picture of himself and a false damaging picture of his opponent. The next time we have a president who engages in stealing, classified information and obstructing the investigation, not in one, but in two alleged ways, and is a president who has engaged in conduct that requires courts to protect witnesses and jurors, exactly, Tavis, what you are talking about, that president should be treated exactly the same way that Donald Trump is being treated. That conduct of criminality and remorselessness for that criminality is what separates him from any, not just any president, but any political leader that we have had in this country since its founding. And I think that it really goes to the point that if we do not hold this person to account with a fair trial and all of the due process rights, we are really not a nation of laws.
It's a New York Times number one bestseller, and that ain't easy to do, but they've done it. And everybody is reading this book in part because, as I say at the top of the conversation, they've made their intellects usable. You can follow it. You can understand it. They break it down in a way that even somebody like me can understand. And I congratulate them and thank them for the fine job they did. The book is called The Trump Indictments, the historic charging documents with commentary, introduced, annotated, and with supporting materials by Melissa Murray and Andrew Weissman, both professors at NYU and both contributors to MSNBC. And I've been delighted to have them both on this program. Melissa, thank you. Good to hear your voice again.
Good to hear you too, Tavis.
Thank you.
And Andrew, good to have you on. Thank you for your time as well. More of Tavis Smiley when we come forward.